the Power User Podcast. I'm your host, Kristen Hatcher, and in this segment, we're talking about some hot topics in tech news. Joining me today are regular contributors to the show, Derek Batting of NeoWin.net. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Kristen.
Tom Chick of Quarter2Three.com. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Good afternoon, everyone.
And Brad Wardell of WinCustomize.com. Hi, Brad.
Matt Damon.
Figures.
Sorry, so, I had to put in that Team America reference in there.
There you go. Right. All right. Before we get too sidetracked on that, let's actually talk about some hot topics in tech news, which is what I said we were going to talk about. The first thing up, Apple acknowledges a problem with the Nano. I know. It's hard to believe.
I can't believe that they made the Nano screen out of the same composite material that they make my car surface out of. Because I tell you, every time I go out there, I see a new scratch. And I think, now I know where this material comes from.
Well, so apparently the problem was, and correct me if I'm wrong, Apple has announced that there is, in fact, a problem with the iPod Nano. If you so much as rub it, Apple hasn't said this part, but apparently if you so much as rub it with a soft cloth, you know, like the cleaning cloth that comes with it, you can get major scratches on it, so much so that people were saying that they couldn't even, it was getting hard to see what was on the screen anymore. Is this what you guys have heard?
Yes, I heard that the iPod sock that we actually talked about on this show scratches it just by having it in the sock.
Right, so that's no good. So Apple actually admitted that there's a problem. They said it's a manufacturing rather than a design problem.
Well, now, is this widespread? Like, is this something that only a small percentage of users have been reporting?
No, universal, all users.
Stop.
Well, now,
stop.
See,
seriously. It'll happen on any machine, apparently, any iPod Nano. Essentially,
Apple is saying that this, some reports at least say that Apple is saying that this has affected less than 0.1% of all the Nanos that have shipped so far. But of course, the users who are on the various forums and threads and flaming are a very vocal majority, or minority rather, if they are a minority.
Well, Apple actually split two ways on this. One of the big outcries was the fact that the Nano screens were cracking and breaking. And everybody was in an uproar about that. And I think that's what they were talking about, the 0.1%. They're saying it's not a design flaw. It was a problem with manufacturing supply with those particular screens. As far as the scratches, they're still kind of crossing their arms and shaking their heads and going, oh, no, it's not a big problem. And if you're going to put it in your pocket with your car keys, you can expect that kind of thing.
Sure. And, of course, that's true. You
but
can.
As far as the broken screens, they've stepped up with AppleCare, and they'll replace any Nano that has a broken screen. So they have acknowledged that. Yeah, as far as the scratches, they're just kind of passing it off, going, no.
Right,
if you're going to rub it on the pavement face down, that's going to happen.
Yeah, or clean it with the cloth, or put it in the sock, or or just, you know, look at it funny.
what Apple has said is that people who are concerned about it should go out and buy one of the many cases that are becoming available. But, of course, you know, if you're carrying it, you know, people are claiming that they're, for example, carrying it in a pocket without anything else in the pocket, which is apparently where Steve Jobs carries his Nano, and it's still getting scratched up. So there's other ways to fix it, I understand. Derek, what did you find out about that?
Yeah, over at Beta News, there was an article about one young man who took his Nano and basically puts it through torture tests to see what works and what doesn't. He uses it as a guinea pig for a multitude of tests. And he came up with the iClear cleaning kit and Brasso. Basically, you just use you don't need the iClear cleaner. That's just optional. But it does come with a nice microfiber cloth. And you use Brasso, and you just rub it on there, wait about 20 minutes, and then all the scratches completely disappear. It's almost better than new. And he said Brasso only costs like $4 American.
Well, at least there's a potential solution then. So everyone hearing that, potential solution. Where can you get that product?
Go get your Brasso. I think you can pick it up pretty much anywhere. Hardware stores, I would assume. It maybe jewelry, cleaners, I'm not sure.
How do you spell it?
Brasso.
All right, so all you iTunes people, go out and get that. Because what I'm getting is people who had the iPod Mini, they had the first iPod, and they never had any scratching problems at all with it. I mean, cell phones, for example, I have it in my pocket with my keys. I don't get scratches. But apparently, like I said, you put it in a sock, it'll scratch. So there's obviously some issue there.
Now, I have to wonder, though, how widespread this is. I'm not necessarily disputing this, but Sony recently released something called a PSP, a little portable gaming device. And shortly after it was released, there was this hue and cry about dead pixels, how every PSP was mortally flawed because there were dead pixels which would show up as little bright white lights. And it was a fairly widespread problem because enough people had it to complain loudly enough that the perception was that every PSP was afflicted with dead pixels. Sony eventually offered to replace them, and it was ultimately a minor problem that a lot of people really bitched about really loudly. So I don't have an iPod Nano, but I'm curious how...
Every person I know that's bought one has this problem.
Has scratched their screen?
Has these scratches. What they are, they're not deep scratches. It's like very, very light surface scratches, which end up making it, reflect light even worse, and it makes it hard to read the screen. So it's not your traditional scratch like you'd see on a cell phone where you can feel it. It's like really light scratches.
Do any of us, out of curiosity, have iPod Nanos?
I don't have a Nano, no.
No, I don't either.
They got me with the Mini, which, by the way, the screen has no scratches on.
As an addendum, PX208 on Beta News left a comment in their forums on the story. It says, Brasso is a polish, and you can get it at most home improvement stores.
There you go.
Yeah, I guess it's primarily for polishing metal.
For $4, it's definitely worth a try, I guess if your screen is becoming scratched up to the point where you can't, it's becoming unusable anyway. You might as well give it a try. But I think, Tom, I think you bring up an excellent point. I don't really know how widespread the problem is. Because I don't really know anybody who's bought
my survey of five people.
There you go.
I mean, that's statistically valid there.
Highly scientific survey, right.
Just a brief anecdotal tale. I actually tried to buy an iPod Nano, and it shut down my credit card. The day it came out, I went on the site in Apple, and I was overcome by gadget lust.
Yes.
And went on the site, immediately entered my credit card, and the site was really slow, and so I must have done the stupid thing where I try to submit my order a few times too many. It didn't go through. It kept clogging up. I finally got over my gadget lust and decided I don't need one of these, and I went away. And over the next few days, my credit card kept getting turned down. And I finally got a call from the fraud department saying, did you try to order, six iPod Nanos from Apple site on this day? I was like, maybe I did. That was an accident. Thanks for catching that.
Right.
Yes,
so that's
I
my
did.
Experience with the iPod Nano right there.
Okay. Well, I guess that's what happens when you try and buy the day. It was the day it comes out, right?
It's a cautionary tale against gadget lust, yes.
That's right. Good job, Tom. Well, in a totally unrelated story, Microsoft acknowledges a problem with its Office suite. Not that they ever tried to deny that there were any problems, but Microsoft has released Office Service Pack 2.
Thank God.
So, in the same vein, in the spirit of fixing problems that are out there, Microsoft has released Service Pack 2 for Office, which provides the latest updates to Office XP. This is for the XP version of Office, I guess. It contains significant security enhancements and improvements in stability and performance. So what do you suppose that means?
I don't know. One problem I know is widespread from reading the news, from reading the news groups on Usenet, where, the bastion of all, truth and
the font
justice,
of knowledge, yes.
Yes. Is you right-click on a file or do a file send to from it, and getting it goes Outlook with the file attached, and I hit the send button and nothing happens. It's just I'm pressing that send button and nothing's happening, or it hangs entirely, which happened today. I wrote this very long email to our PR firm and with an attachment, and I'd done it from Word, and voila, it hung.
Well, they don't say anything about that about specific problems that are being fixed, except that they're saying that Outlook now has improved anti-phishing software, which I'll be very grateful for if it actually works.
But I like phishing.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, out of the usual, if I come in the morning and I get 40 emails, usually 37 of them are some kind of phishing or, some kind of other spam. So.
I don't know. I'm always
Did you know I won the lottery in the UK, by the way?
Well, congratulations.
I found that out this morning, yeah. So I'm quitting.
You know, my PayPal account's really messed up. And I don't have a PayPal account, but apparently it's messed up.
Right.
And
I keep entering in my information
to see if I can get it fixed up, but...
I wasn't going to say anything, but if you guys want, I've got this great deal with this guy in Nigeria who's trying to get money out of the country. So if you guys want in on that, I'd be willing to cut you in.
Oh, I'm
so
there.
That's really generous of you, Tom. I appreciate that.
Just send me up. Just send to where everyone else said, at Stardock.com.
Good job, Brad. I'll be cutting that out for you. Just, yeah. I'll beep it out.
Why bother at this point? It's too
late for me. It's a lost cause.
You know how John on This Week in Tech, John Dvorak is always saying, I get no spam. Well, if you're familiar with the bell curve, of course. If he's at the one end of the bell curve where he gets no spam, then there's at the other end, there's me. I get I'm not exaggerating, 2,000 to 3,000 spam messages a day.
Nice.
Yes, and that's the ones that our servers are not catching, which they are apparently catching an immense amount, that's what you get for not hiding your email address
right,
when you go on Usenet
right, right.
for
wow.
20 years.
Brad, you should fire your technical administrator if that's all getting through.
Yeah. You know, funny thing, we actually currently, as of Friday, do not have any sort of administrator on technical stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's because we suck.
It's admitting that you have
there,
a problem is the first
there, yeah,
step.
Yeah, there's a quote. Stardock, we suck. Brad Woodell, President CEO.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It kind of reminds me, like, on Galaxy's One box, I remember, no, it's Political Machine, that I was going to put a quote on there from my mom where she said, well, the graphics aren't as ugly as your other games.
Nice. That's nice.
It was
thanks,
true.
Mom.
Yeah, it was true, though. The graphics on our games usually do kind of, you know, suck.
They were not up to industry standards.
And I was drawing most of them myself. I don't understand.
With a crayon.
In Microsoft Paint.
Right.
Yeah, in MS Paint, yeah.
Right. So how many of us here are running XP with and using Office? I am.
Yeah, I am too.
Probably all of us.
Yeah.
One of these days, I've kept meaning to try to find an email program that's a little bit more streamlined, maybe some sort of freeware thing, but I just can't be bothered. Everybody's doing it using Office, so why not me?
Yeah, it's what about OpenOffice, Derek? You're not running OpenOffice?
I'm not running OpenOffice. I'm running Office 2003, but for my email program, I did finally make the migration from Outlook to Thunderbird.
And how do you like it?
I do like it. I like it very much. I'm very happy with it. Yeah, obviously it comes kind of stripped down, bare bones, but there are extensions and plugins for Thunderbird that do everything and almost more as far as straight email applications that Outlook does. I'm very pleased with it.
But
so,
it doesn't
Tom,
do
you
any
might
of
want
the,
to look into that.
Yeah, maybe. But does it do any of the calendar stuff that Outlook
does? No, it doesn't include a calendar or a journal or notes or anything like that. However, I believe Mozilla just released a suite that also includes a calendar and some other options like that.
Does it have the little paperclip that comes out and talks to you? Because otherwise, I don't want any part of it.
Right.
Hell no.
Now, isn't that – I thought that was a show with little puppets. Thunderbirds, or
oh yeah, yeah, that's true. I guess
Brad, you're dating yourself. That's Brad right now, just in big neon, put up a sign saying, "I'm 40."
Oh, quite a bit. You got it, Grandpa. I'm not 40. I'm 29. But as long as we're not talking to Thunderbird or the things with the robots that turn into a big robot. No, wait, that's Voltron.
That's Thundercats.
Thundercats, I get it.
Oh,
no.
Thundercats, yeah. I remember that show. All right, now that we've taken a little stroll down memory lane, should we move on, perhaps, to...
Let's move on.
Speaking of Thundercats, Wikibooks.
Right, there we go. That's a good enough topic. Wikibooks. Wikipedia, of course, as you may know, is the open source... I'm about to tell you. It's the open source encyclopedia that lets anyone create or edit articles, and it now has over something like 700,000 entries in English alone. Their next big thing is Wikibooks, which is an attempt to create a complete kindergarten to college curriculum of textbooks that are free based on an open source development model. So Jimmy Wales, who is the co-founder of Wikipedia, said the purpose is really contained in the word freely licensed, which is to make available to anyone in the world in any language a curriculum that they can copy, redistribute, and modify for whatever purpose they may have for free. And of course, he goes on to say that the publishing industry is going to have to recognize that there's a fundamental shift in the marketplace here, which is true. You know, he hopes to get volunteers who would, of course, hopefully be professionals from many fields, college graduates and graduate students and professors and all sorts of geeky people, he says, to write and edit the books in the project. And the idea is that any WikiBooks reader could create his or her own book and make edits to an existing file. Which to me sounds like pie in the sky, kind of, I'm okay, you're okay kind of thinking. You know, I think it's a fantastic idea, but
even
you know,
though
how
this
can
is very
you
much...
trust the stuff that's out there if you just, you know, just any Yahoo can come up and start writing their own book? I don't know.
Well, that's what he was saying, letting more people in on the project and it being quote-unquote open source as it is or what have you, you know, open to the public. They're also calling on university professors, doctors, et cetera, to not only edit it, but have a look at what's already there and make any kind of corrections or elaborations on the material. Hmm. So it is kind of a large, you know, group hug kind of effort.
Right. Right. To put it nicely, Derek, yeah.
And even though it's very much in its infancy, there are already 11,426 submissions. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot.
And I sort of share Kristen's reservations, though. I'm very skeptical about opening up academia like this. I mean, part of the strength and also perhaps a weakness with academia is the rigid peer review that determines what goes into a textbook, what gets taught in a class. It's it's admittedly a very slow, bogged down process, but it's traditionally been effective. Learning is not a bunch of people come together and whatever the majority of them agree on is what gets taught. That's not what academics is about, but that is what Wikipedia is about. It's got a very Darwinian approach to information, which I don't think is safe.
I agree totally with Tom on that. I mean, Wikipedia, as cool as it is, really does express what the consensus is of the average person.
Groupthink.
Exactly. It's groupthink. But I do not think that, especially, you know, I have a son who's in third grade, and I'm not comfortable with the idea that what he gets taught are basically the loudest majority that is possible. I'd rather have, you know, professionals, professional educators be the ones who decide what are the, you know, based on merit, what are the best books, not necessarily what is merely the most popular. Can you imagine how that might affect middle school and high school textbooks, especially on social studies and history and other politically charged categories? Oh, I mean,
right.
Especially given it's international, you can imagine there are kids being taught books on why capitalism is bad and, you know, why the United States, you know, you can imagine the entries for George W. Bush. George W. Bush, a fascist president, and, you know,
right,
who was,
right.
Ill, you know, who stole the election due to his cronies in the Supreme Court. You can imagine all kinds of politically charged nonsense getting in there.
I agree with that, Brad. And I do, however, think there's something to be said with being exposed to all, you know, different viewpoints. However, the problem is that a lot of people, when they're handed a textbook, if they actually read what's in it, they go, oh, okay, that's a fact. Because it's in a textbook, that's a fact. And the biggest problem is not who wrote the book or where it's available or anything. The biggest problem is that people don't seem to realize that maybe not, you know, maybe there's still some room for question in some of the things that they're reading.
There isn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll cut that last bit out then.
Well, Kristen's right. A big part of learning is not just accepting knowledge, but learning how to weigh different bits of information. And that's an important part of learning that you can't discount, whether you're using textbooks or WikiBooks or whatever.
Right. So I think the biggest thing is that, you know, we're not being, in general, people are not taught to, you know, still have some questions left when they reach the end of their education, so to speak. You
well,
know,
here's the primary model between, or difference rather, between Wikipedia and WikiBooks. WikiBooks is for the people who publish the books in the first place. You know, they put their book in a digital format, in a PDF, or in a wiki style out onto the web. Now, this is coming straight from the publishers who have already done the due diligence and, you know, looked through the facts, checked everything twice. And if they were to publish it in a regular book, they would also put it on WikiBooks. And the difference is, rather than updating a textbook, which can usually only be done, say, once a year or however often, you know, they do revisions, it could be updated immediately if there is a falsehood or, you know, something wrong with it, they can go directly into WikiBooks, change it, update it, make it more factual and more truthful instantly. And that information's out there. It's not like any Yahoo out on the web can just go, oh, I'm going to screw up the history of the world, you know, just by logging in to WikiBooks. That's really not – that's the major difference between Wikipedia and WikiBooks. Wikipedia is pretty much for everybody, whereas WikiBooks is for the publishers.
But WikiBooks still does have, though, I mean, different – it's still an interactive process from a broad range of publishers, isn't it?
Very much so. But you're going to get the same kind of thing as, you know, if you walk into a bookstore or a library, you've got all these varying opinions and, you know, varying facts or degrees of facts, you know, just by looking at a wall full of books. It's kind of the same thing here, you know. Read several sources if you want to kind of amalgamate all the information and figure out what's factual and what's not.
Hmm. That's an interesting I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, Derek, because they did say that, you know, what they said was it's based on an open source model, which I guess I took to mean that it's going to be like Wikipedia and that anybody can just, you know, and make a change.
Well, no, not just anyone. Again, primarily this is for professors and publishers and things like that, you know. If it's going to go in, say, popular science, maybe it could also go into WikiBooks. So it would be published maybe in a paper format, but it would also go here as well as a source of information for people on the web.
And then, not buying it, though.
When you go back and you find something wrong with, say, you know, a newspaper article or a magazine or whatever, you have to post in the next issue that, you know, there's a correction, whereas with WikiBooks, you can go in, change it in the original article or add an addendum to it and go from there.
But I'm still not convinced, though, that part of the current publishing model, what's there is that when you publish a book, you're accountable for what you've created, and it's not a collaborative effort between you and publishers X, Y, and Z. You put something out there that's you're staking your reputation on your publishing company. With WikiBooks, doesn't that sort of dilute that whole model?
I think that's a positive thing, because you're going to eventually eliminate more errors than you would then in the typical bound published world.
But we're talking about things, though, that aren't a matter of errors. Take, for instance, Brad's reference to a textbook that lists George W. Bush as the fascist who stole the election. That's not necessarily a factual error as a perspective. And, you know, when you have a bunch of different publishers coming together and fighting to agree on a perspective, I don't know that – I think just the bottom line is open source is all good and well, but I'm not sure it belongs – I'm not convinced that the model works with textbooks. And even if the scale of open source is shrunk down to publishers of textbooks, I'm still not convinced that it works.
I agree with you, Tom, but, if they are at least all getting the chance to publish their own book, which would, you know, I assume have their own perspective, then that might help alleviate that problem a little bit. But I guess I still feel skeptical because, as you pointed out, the peer review process in academia is so entrenched and so such an important part of academia. You know, there's a phrase in the for professors at colleges, which is publish or perish. So, you know, it's incumbent upon them to publish their works or risk losing their jobs. And, you know, there's this whole peer review process they have to go through, and it's kind of entrenched right now. So I'm not sure. I'm not saying that WikiBooks is a bad thing or anything. I'm just not sure that professors are going to immediately migrate to this model. However, you know, in the years to come, perhaps they will.
Well, a little over 11,000 already have.
Right, right.
11,000 articles or 11,000 professors?
11,000 submissions. Yeah, 11,000 submissions.
But we have to also keep in mind, though, Derek, that there's a lot of professors and people out there that don't get their books published, and that there's a reason for that. And it might be politics, but it might be because they didn't have their stuff together.
That's a good point. That's a very valid point.
So that's my two cents. Anybody else have any opinions on this?
Not really.
The advantage of this will be maybe it'll break the stranglehold that there is on textbooks. There's a whole cottage industry with publishing textbooks, and you know, you hear horror stories, and I certainly remember them, about what it costs every semester to buy your textbooks. And, you know, I'd love to see that stranglehold broken. And I'm sure that a lot of students would as well. Brad, when your kids are old enough to go to college, you'll be pretty happy if you don't have to lay out all that money, and they can just go to Wikibooks and get their texts. So.
Oh, yeah. My kids, you know, people talk about homeschooling for elementary. Why do that? That's when it's free. When homeschooling should start when it's at college level.
Another thing, when I was reading this article, I was thinking, what's the difference between Wikibooks and Google Library? Because, you know, they're both kind of headed the same way. Google's looking to take pretty much every book ever printed and put that into their system so it's searchable page for page, word for word. And the thing here is Google's taking copyrighted material and putting it into their system, whereas Wikibooks is setting out to say, hey, if you have something that you want to add to Wikibooks that's free, you know, for everybody to read and use, this is the place to do it.
Yeah, you know, I think the thing about Google Books, because there was actually a, and by the way, Derek, between you and me, I had sworn to have a Google free episode, but you just went and did it anyway, didn't you?
And
you had to bring him in here.
I swore to bust that.
All right, so the thing with Google Books was that they were saying that they were just going to offer little snippets of each of these books to people so that they could kind of get an idea of what the book was about and whether or not they wanted to buy it or something like that. But they were actually digitizing the entire work. And so there was some concern that they were going to be able to eventually distribute that work, you know, without the publisher's permission. So what does the future hold? I just have to wonder what's going to happen in, you know, even 50 or 100 years. It's, you know, it's all going to be digital. And
oh, we'll all be dead by then.
I'll be dead by then, so who cares, right? We just let it go to hell.
Oh, no,
right?
Mankind, we'll have destroyed ourselves somehow.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
All that will be left is cockroaches and wiki books and Google.
Right, yeah, and Google. Well, before the end of the world, we still have some concerns that we need to cover, which one of those apparently this week is Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP, as we're just going to call it now.
Oh, that's a fad. Who even uses that kind of crap?
I don't know. I can't imagine. Of course, we on the show use Skype, which is a free VoIP, Voice over Internet Protocol. The feds are saying, you know, the FCC is saying that there's some issue with Voice over Internet Protocol and 911, calling, you know, an emergency 911 service. And apparently the issue is that if you dial 911 through a Voice over Internet Protocol service, you might not get through, or you might not reach the appropriate call center.
Right. It doesn't know you're on the Internet where you know.
Exactly. But people don't usually, I mean, a lot of people don't really understand the technology. So they assume that if they're using something as a phone, then it will work as a phone does. Another issue with it, of course, is that if the power goes out, you can't use VoIP, but you can use the telephone still. So people are apparently not understanding this, and the FCC is insisting that any provider that provides VoIP services must inform their users and receive back an acknowledgement that they have gotten the information, or else they're going to have to cut off their VoIP service.
Yeah, a couple of companies have already done this by putting it in their terms of service and sending out a notice saying, please, you know, read this and sign it so you can continue to use our service. And when they click, yes, I accept this agreement, problem solved.
Yeah, it's in the Skype user agreement and user license agreement. I actually read the entire thing. Yes, I did. I took one for the team, is what happened. I read the entire Skype and user license agreement, which I would like to point out for those of you that use Skype and have never read the license agreement. If you actually try and read it in their little pop-up window that they have, you scroll down and it actually becomes like something like a one-point font. You actually cannot physically read it. You have to copy and paste it into another document to read it.
Wow. That's where they get you.
Yeah, I tell you, that's called fine print. So, yeah, I went through it all, and what they basically said is, if you try and call 911, you might experience some trouble. That's the bottom line. So, be warned.
They've covered their asses.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Now, is this all stuff that's happened in the wake of Katrina? Is this part of this post-Katrina freakout, or is this something the FCC has been trying to do for a while?
This is something apparently the FCC has been trying to do for a while. They just extended the deadline again. It was supposed to be, I believe, the end of September that any VoIP provider was to have 100% compliance from their customers or to disrupt the service for those who haven't acknowledged that there might be a problem. They've extended it another month now, so
Actually, you know, Katrina actually helped put into perspective how important it is to have voice over IP technology, because in the wake of Katrina, Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, used voice over IP technology when all the other telecommunications were down. So that was his link to the outside world, and that became a big issue and opened the eyes of a lot of senators and said, hey, you know, you need to lay off.
That would explain
these rigid
that would
things.
Explain how he was so effective in administering the.
We all know, Brad, that was George Bush's fault, not Ray Nagin's.
Oh, that's right. How about the governor? Why don't we compromise and blame the governor?
Why don't we blame the government in general?
I'm curious Ray Nagin has a broadband phone. That's correct. Like, he was making these calls on a broadband phone, right?
Right. Yes.
What electricity was he using?
Yeah, like, how does – if he's got a broadband phone, is it because, like, cellular towers were down? But they're – I guess as the sort of tech retard here, I don't understand why he could make a broadband call cell
Tom,
call.
No, Tom, you're a tech special person.
I'm tech differently abled, I
that's
know.
That's right. Well, I think maybe it was a generator. I did read that article, actually, and I don't think it's
specified. Kristen, were you there in New Orleans or not? Okay, I guess that's what people want to know. Were you there or not?
I wasn't there. I'm sorry.
So you weren't even there.
Now is not the time to play the blame game.
That's right. You know what I found interesting, though, I will say, is that apparently the mayor was calling the president using voice over internet protocol. So that means the president has an address somewhere, right? So do you think he uses Skype?
Oh, yeah.
Let's type in his name.
If we just type in POTUS, do you think he'll answer?
I doubt he's figured out his electric razor yet.
Ooh.
Anyway, to those of our listeners that use VoIP, understand that you may have an issue. In general, calling 911 through a VoIP service is usually very reliable, but it isn't always reliable. And when you call 911, you pretty much want 100% accuracy. So you might want to keep a cell phone handy if you think that might, you know, be something that will come up for you in the future.
This actually raises the question on VoIP, what is the number for 911? I don't know. I'm just wondering, if I've got VoIP, how do I dial 911? Do you dial like a regular phone? Is that?
Well, Derek, you use Skype as your phone, don't you?
I always dial 912 because that's what my Stonecutter membership allows me to do.
I see. Well, we won't get too deeply into that because, you know.
I'm sorry. When anyone asks what the number for 911 is, I just crack up.
Dial 911? I haven't actually ever used Skype as a regular telephone.
No, with Skype,
I just type in somebody's name.
Yeah, it's not possible with Skype. I believe it says right on their homepage, you know, this is not to be used for emergency services, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. So you've never – do you use Skype only as your telephone, Derek, or do you use other services?
Yeah, I use Skype exclusively. I don't have a landline.
So if you have a problem, you're just dead.
If I need to call 911, then, one, I know I can't do it, and even if I could, I would probably have to wait until my download finished.
Yeah, we certainly couldn't mess up that download, right?
But I'm downloading the Galstiv 2 trailer. This sucking chest wound can wait.
All right, well, hopefully nothing will happen to you, Derek, until you do get a cell phone, which I understand is an event that's looming on the horizon. So, good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, get off.
I'll just disconnect you now. Okay, enough of that junk. Tom, what's going on in games these days? Enlighten us.
It's been a fairly busy week the past week. A bunch of things happened. The company that made Myst died and revived again.
Excellent.
Do they smell funny, though? Like, you know, kind of sickly sweet? Because they could still be dead, but they're just a zombie.
Are they zombies now? Because that's pretty awesome.
Normally, when a company dies and then declares they're not dead, it is a zombie situation. There may be a skeleton crew of two or three people manning the phones. All the furniture has been sold off, and they're wistfully sitting in their offices waiting for some sort of a deal.
Yeah, but they're saying,
this actually appears to be legitimate.
I feel happy.
I'm not dead yet.
I think Cyan, there's the real indicator, and this is the case with Cyan, is Have they hired all their staff back? And Cyan says they indeed have. So something's up. They can't say what yet, of course, pending an announcement. But Rand Miller, the fellow behind the company, has told a few outlets that, yes, we've rehired our staff. I can't say what is going on, but we're back.
And so, working on the iPod Nano screens.
Yeah, really. Maybe they're going to remake Master of Magic 2. What do you think, Brad?
Shut up.
Ooh, touched a nerve.
Gotcha.
I know where you live.
Stay tuned every week, folks. Brad always gets a beating.
I think that's why most of our listeners tune in, actually.
I thought it was for singing.
Well, that's right. And who has sung on this episode?
No one. I think Tom said he was going to sing some Andrew Lloyd Webber songs.
Oh, is it my turn?
Lay it on,
Tom. I have to warm up. Before I sing, though, a couple of other gaming-related issues from last week. A very successful game from Electronic Arts called Battlefield 2 came out a month or so ago.
And we're having a game day here playing Battlefield 2 tomorrow afternoon, Tom. You should get some of the quarter to three gang and team up. You can kick our ass.
It's an ideal game for that sort of thing. Battlefield 2 has this great squad support, where rather than people just sort of futzing around on the same team, vaguely chasing the same objectives, you work a lot more closely with small groups of people. It's this great sort of social structure they've built into what might otherwise be a lot of mindless, crazy, over-the-top shooting. And they're taking this social structure one step further. A company called Planet Combat has been hired by Electronic Arts, the publisher of the game, to create this meta game whereby you sign up, you pay a little money, it basically comes down to $40 a year, and then you're assigned to a division under the command of a general. The general looks at a map of interconnected nodes that's superimposed over either Iraq for some battles or Asia for other battles, and you move around the nodes and you play different matches, and depending on how you do against the other divisions, you can claim nodes. It's sort of a strategy shell that adds extra life to the game. It's a great move. I'm a little skeptical about Electronic Arts and Planet Combat expecting people to continue to pay for a feature like this, but it'll add some extra life to the game, as if it needed it. It's doing very well. It's an amazing game, and now there's even more reason to waste time with it.
Hey, Tom.
Sir.
What's going on with that Nutty Carmack guy over at id?
Which one? Because there are two.
that's a key.
The lesser known of the two. And oddly enough, they're not related.
Yeah, id, the Wall Street Journal, to their credit, dug around through some court records recently, which is the sort of thing that none of us guys who do game reviews and stuff is qualified to do. I wouldn't know. If someone were to hand me a court record, I'd be asleep before getting beyond the first paragraph. That stuff makes no sense to me. So they have real journalists at places like the Wall Street Journal.
I'm glad you said that, and not me.
They'll actually read these things, and they'll do research, and they'll call people for comments. And so one of the stories that came out last week is that there was a failed takeover bid from Activision to acquire id Software. A phenomenally successful company that has made Doom, Quake, Wolfenstein, and a game that Derek fondly recalls, Commander Keen.
Yeah.
And so there was a failed takeover bid for something like $100 million. The talks broke down, didn't work out. Shortly thereafter, Adrian Carmack, one of the founders of the company, no relation to John Carmack, the higher profile fella, was let go. And it turns out that these court papers that were filed sort of point to some dirty dealings that were going on in the company. It seems that Carmack somehow has acquired a 41% stake in ownership in id Software, and
Bloody impressive, by the way. I mean,
yeah, for one fellow to pull all that together, good for him. And he refused a $20 million buyout bid. Now, if you do the math, Activision's trying to acquire you for $100 million. You've got a 41% stake. Therefore, you would think, hey, it's worth $41 million. My colleagues are offering me $20 million. Something's wrong here. If you do the math, it seems like something was going on. It was maybe a little bit underhanded. So Adrian Carmack is out, and it seems that we now realize that it was under less auspicious circumstances than we might have thought when the announcement was made. And the typical things were said about he wants to pursue his own creative vision, that sort of thing. So it wasn't quite so benign.
I was thinking what would be a great game for him to pursue is, you know, has anyone ever thought of making a first-person shooter, but where you have a sidekick? You know, you go around and you have to go get some special talisman and make it kind of a Japanese-type you know, backdrop with a – have a title be some sort of unnameable thing. And then you have give the sidekicks some goofy names. You know, I can't think of any offhand, but, you know, make sure that those have some goofy names but don't have them have any pathfinding, because I think that would make a great game.
I don't think it would work, Brad, unless you put robot frogs into it.
Ooh, touche.
We are, of course, speaking about John Romero, another co-founder of id. His Daikatana is a widespread industry joke for being a bad game with an even worse marketing campaign behind it.
Well, speaking as someone who's been his bitch, it's not pleasurable.
Yeah, id has a long trail of corpses behind it. A lot of bloody battles involved with id and former id members. I mean, I think that happens anywhere, though, where that much money springs up around people who are that young.
No, Tom, that's not it. It all proves violence in video games begets violence in business.
All right, Tom, thank you for that. Do you have a pick of the week for us?
I do. My pick of the week is a game for the Sony PlayStation that will just come out. One that I could absolutely recommend to all of you, because a very, very accessible game. Even someone like Derek, I think, could pick this up and just enjoy the hell out of it.
Even
Derek, yes. There was a game that came out for the Dreamcast maybe 4 years ago or so, Virtua Tennis. I don't know the first thing about tennis. I do not know a Venus from a Serena. I don't know what this whole scoring thing is, where every time you get a point, you actually get 15 points. None of that makes any sense to me. So you wouldn't think that I would be the kind of guy who would enjoy a game about tennis. But Virtua Tennis, as it came out on the Dreamcast so long ago, was sort of tennis meets Pong, where you're just moving a guy around on your side of the court, and if you happen to position him where the ball is coming, he does this really fancy animation, and he hits it back. And it's a very gratifying way to effectively just move a paddle around and watch it do fancy stuff. Great for two-player games. They recently ported Virtua Tennis to the PSP, Sony's beautiful, sleek, amazing little handheld game player, and it looks wonderful. The animation is all there. The easy control is all there. And for a guy like me who doesn't know the first thing about tennis, it's just as addicting as ever. There's even a great role-playing system where you create your own tennis player and you move him around the world and do challenges with him and you play tournaments and he makes money and he improves his statistics, sort of a tennis RPG. So
wow.
My pick of the week, Virtua Tennis World Tour for the Sony PSP.
All right.
That sounds cool.
I have to check it out.
Tom doesn't know his Venus
PSP.
From a hole in the ground.
Venus?
Or his Serena. Well, I'm going to have to go buy a PSP then, I guess, if I'm going to play that game.
There is, a fairly high barrier for entry, namely a expensive PSP, yes. Mm-hmm.
But it would be a good excuse.
You know, the PSP does play movies. Now, I'm just kind of wondering, can those movies be played like on a, if you have a Sony DVD player, can you put those DVD movies and will it play on those?
No. The little movies are these tiny proprietary sort of mini discs and cartridges that only work on a PSP. That whole using the PSP to play movies angle, I don't think is very effective. You have to buy it separately. You can't watch it on a DVD player. It only works on a little tiny screen.
But if Sony should just make it so that if you buy a Sony DVD player, it supports that format. And
it would certainly sell more of those proprietary movie formats if they did it that way.
Yeah, because otherwise that's crazy.
Now Sony wants you to buy a PSP, Brad. You're gonna have to.
One of us.
Well, you know, if I have to drink, smoke, do drugs to be cool, I guess it's not that much more to go on and buy a PSP.
Well, wait a minute. You don't do any of those other things, and you're not cool. So why would you need to buy a PSP?
Two beatings in one episode.
Yeah, I'm having a bad week.
I still like you, Brad.
Yeah, you're pretty okay. You're all right, Brad.
I'm wearing my 2:45 shirt. Actually, no, I'm not. I meant to wear it today. It's cool.
Oh, one other gaming announcement, actually. It just came out on, I believe, Friday. There's an upcoming RPG called Oblivion. from Bethesda, and they do these amazing, like, wide open, free-form, single-player RPGs. It's very much like a multiplayer one. And they just announced their voice cast, which these are sort of goofy announcements a lot of the times, and they'll sort of show how Hollywood and game development are starting to sort of awkwardly mesh with each other.
What? No
you get
way.
Celebrity talent. it's happening slowly but surely. Celebrity talent sort of throws their lot in with different games. So here's the voice cast so far for Oblivion. You have Patrick Stewart. Nothing special. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting some game where Patrick Stewart is doing a voice.
TV, yeah, or any commercial for that. For televisions with Dalmatians, for that matter.
He's out. He gets himself out there. He does a great job. All of us geeks are familiar with Patrick Stewart being in different places. But here are the exciting ones. Also in Oblivion, Sean Bean played Boromir in the Lord of the Rings movie, but also just a great actor. Terrence Stamp. The limey, I think he was in one of those. Yeah, he was in those Star Wars movies. But Terrence Stamp is amazing, and this is an amazing distinctive voice. I love Terrence Stamp. I don't think he's been in a game yet. So he'll be in Oblivion. And here's the clincher. Linda Carter.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Linda Carter
it's
herself.
It's about the damn time.
The stuff of fantasy from 40-year-old guys like me and Brad.
Could be a career resurrection.
You know? I'm not 40 either, by the way. I'd just like to point that out.
I'm not 40.
I swear I'm not 40. I swear.
Yeah, there.
Lies.
Yeah, I've got another year before I have to start saying I'm 40. But I do recall Linda Carter, and that's just very cute that she's doing Oblivion.
That's very cool. I'm glad to hear that.
So that's it for game news.
All right. I think that's all of our news for the week, actually.
Hey, Age of Empires 3 comes out in the next few weeks. Isn't
yes, it does.
This month, as well as Black and White 2.
Civilization 4.
And Civilization 4. It's going to be a busy month.
We just went to see Serenity. Stardock took a day to go see the movie Serenity, and they showed a trailer, a preview for Doom.
The movie.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that look?
Like it's going to make me sick.
Yeah, they're trying to make it a first-person shooter.
Yeah, it's shot from the angle like you're playing the game. You know, all you see is going through corridors, and you see the gun in front of you, and then monsters jump
right
out.
Now, have you ever watched somebody else play a first-person shooter on a big screen? I mean, it's like getting motion sickness. I mean, I can play them all day myself, but if you start watching someone else play, especially if they're on a big, you know, 20-inch screen. You know, let alone on a theater size screen, you're in for a ride.
Right, that's true. But in that movie's defense, I will say it was just the trailer, and they might have used every single piece of first person footage that they had in the trailer.
So yeah,
and
so
maybe it's only a
like
couple
most
minutes.
Trailers, it's designed to turn people off. So.
Yeah,
the first person stuff in the Doom movie is only a small part of it. I mean, that's sort of a nod to game players. Otherwise, it looks to me like this very conventional sort of derivative. Military comes in and fights zombies at a secret base movie.
Unlike the game, which is, you know, cynical.
So, in other words, a perfect adaptation.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much for joining me again this week. I appreciate having you on, of course.
Thank you for having us, Kristen.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Matt Damon.
Good. Excellent. And thanks for listening, everyone. This podcast was brought to you by NeoWin.net, WinCustomize.com, and QuarterTo3.com. Support us by subscribing to us on iTunes, PodNova, or Odeo.com. And look for us every week at www.poweruser.tv.